We've got the Academy Awards, the Emmys, and Grammys. But what should we call the award for the most extraordinary performance by a corporate profiteer? How about the Sleazy, with winners getting a solid gold sculpture of a middle finger? There were so many worthy contenders, but one corporation exhibited uncommon callousness, so the 2021 Sleazy goes to Tyson Foods. The meatpacking giant has regularly run roughshod over workers, farmers, communities, and the environment, not to mention the millions of animals it fattens and slaughters. But the coronavirus pulled out the worst in Tyson's corporate ethic. Last April, its billionaire chair, John Tyson, ranted that health officials who were closing down several of his slaughterhouses that had become hotbeds of contagion were creating another crisis, a national meat shortage. Responding instantly, our corporate compassionate burger-gobbling president decreed that meatpacking plants were crucial to America's national security and must be kept open at all cost. Trump's edict required workers to return to their jobs or be fired. Only, there was no meat shortage. Indeed, Tyson and other giants actually increased their meat exports to China last year. Meanwhile, COVID rampaged through Tyson's factories. In its Waterloo, Iowa facility alone, a third of the processing workers were infected and at least six died. Which brings us to the corporate play that cinched this year's sleazy for Tyson. Waterloo slaughterhouse supervisors actually knew that the back-to-work order would sicken hundreds, but not exactly how many. So, managers organized a winner-take-all betting pool on the percent of employees who would test positive. It was simply something fun, said one, kind of a morale boost. This is Jim Hightower saying the virus infected more than a third of the workers in the plant. Some fun, huh? The Hightower Radio Lowdown is brought to you by the Lowdown Happy Hour, live streamed from the Chat and Chew Cafe. Details at HightowerLowdown.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, yesterday you had the Senate Republicans doing their foolhardy best to make sure that income inequality continues, just as well as it's been. You know, make sure that women don't get paid the same as men. We can't have the Paycheck Fairness Act because, as Mitch McConnell said, it's a, how did he put it, the left's parade of you know, liberal wish list stuff. That's good old Mitch. Scary times. But here's the thing. Inequality is very real. We see families who are struggling every day. And it's not just the poor and the low-wage working class. It's folks who have actually, over the last couple of decades, done pretty okay. Their wages haven't kept up, but they were significantly high enough that they could make ends meet. Problem is that's kind of rolling back, which is why I'm thrilled to see the good folks over at Capital in Maine have been on this campaign, the 5100 pay gap program that they're doing. And one of the stories that they look at is just that. The families who are doing okay, but they're wondering, how are their kids going to make this? That's why I've asked Jessica Goodhart to come talk with us. Jessica is a senior reporter there at Capital in Maine. Her most recent piece, How an American Family Raised on GE Wages Copes with Income Inequality. Jessica, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So that's an interesting question. You know, how is it that someone who, General Electric paid really good wages, and I've got friends who used to work at the locomotive plant in Erie until they shut that down. But these are people who did really well. How are they going to make it?
Yeah, no, great question. So you mentioned in your intro the 5100 project, and I just wanted to unpack a little bit for your listeners what that refers to. Last fall, the RAND Corporation released this really interesting study that documented the full extent of the income shift since the 1970s from the middle class and the working class to the wealthiest Americans. We all feel it, but they kind of came up with a number that I think is really illuminating, and that is that a full-time worker currently earning the national median wage of about 50 grand would be making close to $100,000 now if the country's economic growth had continued to be shared over the last 45 years,
yep,
the way it was in the decades after World War II. So that's a $50,000 kind of productivity gap. And what we've done at Capital Maine, we've set out to document why this has happened from a policy perspective, you know, the decisions that people made. It wasn't just this sort of global forces. There were actual decisions that were made that led to this shift, this income shift, but also what it means to people from different occupations and walks of life. And the story that you referred to, that's my story, is about a particular family in Lynn, Massachusetts, a father, a daughter, and a son, Wayne McCall and his two children, Kathleen and Kevin, who I had the opportunity to meet Wayne and Kathleen and then talk to Kevin, who lives in Maine, actually, over the phone. And they're such an interesting family because they've been with the Riverworks plant there in Lynn for five generations, actually.
Wow.
And they've really seen the sort of rise and, you know, decline of those GE wages. Wayne McCall, who's the father in the story, he, you know, started at the bottom in the late 60s, you know, cleaning metal scraps from, you know, he said he was a trash collector, you know, cleaning up in the plant. And when he retired, he was one of the highest rated inspection jobs. And he talks with great pride about the skills he gained while he was working there. He raised four children, has a house that he owns in Lynn. He has a summer place in Maine. He had a boat. A really nice life that he was able to build.
Live the American dream.
You know, in that plant. It's the American dream. Exactly, exactly. And I was just, you know, listening to this. And so it's partly, you know, it's certainly the living standards, but also just a sense of pride in the work and the real loyalty. To the company, and you know, and an expectation of loyalty in return. And his daughter, you know, sort of got a piece of that too. She's a machinist, very proud of her skills and her work, and she makes a pretty good wage as well, about $35 an hour. It doesn't go as far because of the high cost of living now, as does her, you know, as she feels like things are more expensive. And I think because of the cost of housing, the cost of healthcare, everything feels more expensive. And that's that sort of productivity gap, right? She'd be making more, and you can sort of look at the RAND Corporation study to see that she'd be making, I think, about 30% more, given the sort of income percentile, if she were, you know, productivity growth had kept pace with wages. But still, she's doing pretty well. Compared to many, many in the workforce, and she knows it. But here's the thing, and this is what she really emphasized in the story. There, you know, she was concerned for her children. I think, as you mentioned, she was concerned because in 2016 there was a union agreement, a wage concession that the union was made to keep jobs in Lynn. There has been over many decades an offshoring work in the plant. So I was told by the local president there that I believe in the 1950s there were maybe in all of Lynn about 24,000 jobs that GE provided. I think some of them might have been not just at the plant. And then, you know, now they're just a few thousand jobs at the plant. So there's been a huge decline in the number of jobs. And so the union, to keep jobs there, they agreed to a contract that meant that new hires, instead of making, would make significantly less, right? And so that there was big wage concessions. And the other thing is that Kathleen, you know, has this pretty good job. Her brother, he had the misfortune of graduating from trade school when Jack Welch, who was nicknamed Neutron Jack,
yep,
some of your listeners might know, was CEO, and he was unable to get a job at GE. And so he had a much different trajectory and a much different story, which I talk about in the piece.
No, and it's, you know, it's the story of a lot of families and why I think there's such economic anxiety and such, you know, such struggle in this country. And, you know, I tell the story all the time that, you know, when I started working in the freight industry back in, you know, the late 80s, I was making, you know, $15 an hour to start. And if you did, you go to the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics inflation calculator, that's like $32 an hour today. So it goes right in line with what the RAND Corporation has come around with. It goes right into line with what you're saying. You know, back when unions were much stronger, back when we had a tax code that was much saner, back before we had horrible trade agreements and funded the exodus of manufacturing jobs from this country, we had significant bargaining power and wages, benefits, and all of those things were better. And we've seen them not just stagnate, but decline over the last couple of decades.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, what you can do, and maybe we'll be able to have produce something interactive for this project, but you can sort of, if you read the story, you can actually also press on a link to the RAND study, and there's a chart that shows the different wage, I guess they're quartiles or whatever, like where you land, and you could say, well, what would I be making if income had increased along with productivity? Wow, I'd be making, 20-30% more than I am now, because no matter where you are, unless you're in sort of the top percentile, you would be making a lot more because the productivity is not being shared along the wage progression as it once was. Like, we're not all growing together as we once were. And what's kind of interesting too about this particular plant is that it's they've built airplane engines, and their customer is, for military, their customer is often the federal government. They do also build engines for foreign governments. But it's just interesting too, because they, and this doesn't really come out in the story so much, but they are receiving a lot of government money too. And that's a point that was brought up to me by, various people who I interviewed for the story.
Yeah, which is, again, when I talk about using our tax dollars to raise working conditions, this is part of why I think it's important that we attach conditions to the spending, our procurement spending, so that we do raise conditions, even if the corporate CEOs don't want to.
Yeah. And there's a campaign right now in the town of Lynn to try to get General Election to reshore jobs, and you can see signs in the windows of businesses that say "Love us, don't leave us," and the businesses, the local businesses, understand that the fate of that community is very much tied to the plant there in Lynn. So it's a story that could be it's about that town, but it could be about, like you said, Erie or some other town in Pennsylvania or Ohio or anywhere else, that has an industrial-based economy. Yeah,
it's about every one of those small communities across this country that Donald Trump went to and won over by telling them that he was going to bring back their past, that he was going to bring the factory back, that they were going to make those life-altering wages that are going to be able to make sure that they can buy a house, put their kids through college, take vacations, buy cars, buy a summer home up in Maine and a boat and all of those other things, and that that American dream that was once possible through the sweat of your labor and solid working class values and the strength of unions has been stripped away, and it happened quickly. I would argue this stuff, it wasn't a slow grind. This stuff happened, 1980 forward, in my view, was just the decimation of the working class as we deindustrialized, communities across this country. And I watched it happen growing up in Cleveland. Cleveland was an industrial powerhouse, and it was stripped of its economic might for first Southern states and then right on out of the country.
Yeah, no, it's, and the town of Lynn, you know, has this incredible tradition that goes back actually to the, you know, all the way back to the 19th century of, you know, working class struggle and so on. And so I think it's, you know, these are, I think you do a great job on your show of really talking not only about the present, but sort of linking it back to the, you know, to the history. And I think what was so interesting to me too is that this was a family that really had a sense of its own, you know, their own history. And
that's
so, like legacy. Kathleen said to me, their own legacy. That Kathleen said to me, you know, I have my grandmother's, you know, badge that she wore at GE. But she's not going to recommend that her children work at GE. So there was a sense of that tradition dying out, and you know, not just the decision of the decisions that the company is making, but sort of the decisions that the workers themselves are making about, you know, whether there's a future in manufacturing, and you know, and you know, tr- you know, very skilled work, you know, that these folks are doing.
Yeah, it's interesting though. You know, you talk about you know generational work, and you know, just in the last hour, I talked about, you know, a kid that I had met who, you know, he's going to be the first kid to graduate from college, who said, you know, look, my grandfather wanted to go to college, he couldn't. And my father, you know, he wanted to, you know, went off to war and that stuff. He said, I'm going to be the first to graduate. But I don't have any choice but to graduate, because the place that, you know, grandpa and the father went back to, the mill in town, it's gone. So the last, mm-hmm. the last option, the last hope is to get an education. I'm glad that they have the option of maybe going back to a lower paying gig there. And that's sadly what's happened all across the country. We've seen contracts that have sold out the unborn and future employees. So that we can maintain and give the corporations what they need now, but at the cost of the next generation. And that's kind of sad to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, the union president I spoke to, he did emphasize that there's a very strong trade school and pipeline, you know, there, and that there has been investment in the Boston area and in the trade schools. And so, you know, it's there. I think the feeling, you know, the feeling that was being expressed by Kathleen DeSisto, the woman featured in the story, is just that the sense of the lack of commitment on, you know, on the part of the employer. And one of the things I think that was interesting, I mean, you mentioned about college. I think within that family, I think there are four children. I think at least one or maybe two of the adult children in the family, you know, had gone to college, and certainly, but some of them really wanted to be in the trades, you know, and so some people want to go to college, some people want to be in the trades. And yeah. So, you know, it's just, they're different pathways, and, you know, and certainly they felt like it was such an important pathway for their family to have, you know, to have that option. You know, one of the people featured in the story, Kevin McCall, has decided to move up to Maine, and he, you know, he struggled. He's had like 11 different jobs and has not been able to save. Finally, in his 50s, he's, you know, cobbled together enough to buy a house where he's going to live with his two adult, you know, young adult children. And, you know, you sort of contrast that to his father's story, who bought a house in his 20s, you know, when, you know, after he got his job at GE, and you really see the difference. Is this, I think, as you said in your introduction, is this like the most, you know, heart-wrenching story of hardship you've ever heard? No. But, you know, it really shows, you know, it shows the decline of the American dream, like what, you know, what once what was and what is so different. And I think the way they experienced, the way Kevin McCall talked about his hopes and dreams about getting a job at GE, and his, you know, deep disappointment and not being able to get in the door, was really interesting to me. You know, it was really spoke a lot about how you know, what these jobs mean to, you know, folks in these communities, and I think, you know, kind of what we're, you know, and what we're dealing with in this country. And I think not everyone's really in touch with it.
Oh, which is why I'm a big supporter of reshoring our manufacturing, firing up trade schools again, giving people the option and the ability to make good, solid, middle class, life sustaining wages in these jobs, and the pride that comes with it. I mean, you talked about the pride that, you know, this family has and being part of that company. And sadly, you know, and I've talked about this for years, the compact between the working class and the employers has been long broken. Sadly, we're just, you know, negatives on a balance sheet, easily discarded. And for me, this is part of what has to change.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for reading the story and talking about it. And I hope your listeners will check out our series, because we should have a lot more and exploring, you know, lots of different types of occupation. We have stories about a social worker, actually, and it's a similar kind of story, believe it or not, where things have gotten, you know, much harder, you know, family of social workers where, you know, from one generation to the next, it gets
looking forward
more
to that coming out as well.
Yeah.
We're going to get links out on social media.
Up. Yeah.
We'll get links out on social media so folks can check out the story. You guys are doing great work. Keep it up. I hope you'll come back and share some more with us.
Okay. You take care. Thank you so much.
Good stuff. Thank you, Jessica Goodhart. The piece, How an American Family Raised on GE Wages Copes with Income Inequality. We'll get links out on how you can take a look at that. Gonna take a quick break. Right back. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. That was the day Consumers Power Company employees near Flint, Michigan, shut off generators and turbines at the Zilwaukee Power Plant. 2,000 workers organizing with the Public Utilities Union under the direction of the UAW effectively cut off power to everything except hospitals, city sanitation plants, and dairies. The company's office workers joined the walkout, hanging a banner across the Flint District office building that read, "Quit stalling." The company had dragged its heels on an agreement promising union recognition, a closed shop, wage increases, and an end to 24-hour scheduling of troubleshooters. The strike cut power to an estimated 165,000 Flint residents. It also forced the closing of 6 area General Motors plants and impacted industrial centers like Saginaw and Bay City. The strike ended a temporary truce that Governor Frank Murphy had forced between the UAW and Consumers Power, which ended a several-hour-long walkout at the power plant earlier in the month. The strike paralyzed 13 counties across the Saginaw Valley. When news of the second strike hit, Murphy put the National Guard on standby. He snapped orders at UAW leader Homer Martin to get those lights back on. I will not stand by and see those people in darkness tonight. Top union officials insisted the strike was unauthorized and that a tentative settlement had been reached. But workers demanded to see the actual terms of the agreement before they agreed to go back to work. The workers ratified the contract. Tensions continued. Governor Murphy demanded that the county sheriff organize a special force to prevent future utility strikes, while the UAW vowed to curb wildcat strikes through investigation and discipline. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
The reality is, and look, I think the folks over at Capital in Maine do an incredible job of highlighting inequality and talking about how things, well, I think should be and how they used to be. Look, I go back to when I first started working, and I'll tell you, I didn't know how good I had it. I really didn't. I knew I had a good amount of money. I knew I wasn't in debt. I was able to pay off my student loans really quickly. You know, I had a good living. And it was because, you know, now that I look back on it, The wages were incredible. Like I said, you know, I started off, you know, $15 an hour was, you know, back in the late 80s, early 90s, was like today, you know, $30-$32 an hour. It was a substantial living. And, you know, I remember having a conversation recently with a guy who's a recruiter for a company that does the kind of work that I was in. And, you know, he was lamenting over the fact that they can't get people to come in the door at $18 an hour, because that's what they're starting people off at today, $18 an hour. And you go, well, $18 an hour isn't 30. You're a little light. If you want to get the kind of people you got back then, you want to get people lined up around the door, you're going to have to dig a little deeper. And he didn't want to hear that, but that's the reality. Because you stop and think about it. You go back, you know, over 30 years, that starting wage has only gone up, you know, $3-$4 an hour. I mean, that's insane. When the cost of gasoline is more than tripled, when the cost of, you know, everything else is more than tripled, I mean, it's crazy. But what's happened is, and, you know, the reality is we shifted our entire economy based on appeasing the very wealthy. Our entire economy was shifted to make the wealthier wealthier, and to make sure that they got what they needed, because, hey, they're the smart ones. And they always cook up these schemes on how to steal from us. You know, you go back to the 80s, it was all about busting up the unions, all about busting up people's ability to demand better wages, hours, conditions. Then they sold us on everybody had to buy a house. So they got people locked into buying homes. And well, when the bubble burst, they snatched them all away. And now what we're seeing, in fact, the Wall Street Journal, I had a listener send me this story. I hadn't seen it. It's from back in April. But I had a listener send me this, and they say, hey, have you seen this? And I didn't. The reason housing prices are going up so quickly, they're claiming, is according to this Wall Street Journal article, that pension funds and BlackRock and some of these private equity firms are buying up all the houses. They're buying up as many houses as they can at significantly higher prices than what they're going for. They're just buying stuff up like crazy. Why? Well, one would argue that they're borrowing a bunch of money. They're able to leverage a bunch of capital to buy up these properties, to rent them back to us so that we pay the rent on them and they get to own them and cash in down the road as the value goes up, knowing that, well, if this scheme doesn't work out and the bottom falls out and we have another boom and another bust, that the federal government's going to bail them out. This is horrible. I mean, this is one of those things that make you go, there's something seriously wrong, where the working class of this country is never going to be able to get ahead. Because, you know, you build wealth by owning a home. That's the for most working families, that's the first way that they build some wealth and some intergenerational wealth. And I look at myself, you know, I had nothing. I grew up in the projects. I never imagined that I'd be able to own a home and to buy another one and to do any of those things. But because I had that job, a good, solid union wage job, made good decisions, worked hard, played by the rules, did all that stuff, we were able to buy a house. We were able to put money away. We were able to buy, you know, a second house, you know, to help our daughter get started in her life, all because of, well, that first house. Because we had equity into it, we were able to pull out to help do that stuff. That's being taken away from the next generation. Because they're claiming that places like BlackRock are out there buying up tons of these houses. So when you see them, you know, you see these, you know, the guy on Eric buys houses, or, you know, whoever these people are, Bob's buying houses, or John's buying houses, or, you know, people are buying houses. Where are they getting all this money from? We'll pay you above market range and you can still live there. Sounds too good to be true, because it usually is. Anytime someone tells you something that sounds too good to be true, it is. And I keep thinking back to the old company store model. I can't get the history of our country out of our mind, where working people who work for, you know, the mill or for the mines or for whatever, you know, the chocolate factory, they were indebted for their entire lives to the company store. Their housing, their meals, their health care, their education, everything. Indebted to corporate America. And now we don't have the company store per se anymore. We've got multiple company stores. And they're consolidating. It's not much different. And now we're going to be moving into an era where nobody's going to own anything. We're going to constantly be paying rent. We're going to constantly be making their wealthier and wealthier. Something seriously wrong. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Maine to New Mexico, the U.S. is seeing historic high temperatures, sweltering in dangerous hot air that's arrived earlier than usual, catching many off guard. Tonight, major cities from Boston to Washington, D.C. are declaring weather emergencies.
Extreme heat hits the U.S., breaks all-time high records in the Middle East. Atmospheric CO2 levels now highest in more than 4 million years. Plus,
the way we humans live on Earth is sending it into a decline.
Sir David Attenborough is done being nice about climate change.
Yeah, me too. All of those stories and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
In neighboring Utah, the dry conditions prompted the governor to call for a weekend of prayer.
We need more rain, and we need it now. We need some divine intervention.
Aha! Republicans in Utah finally admit climate change is man-made because man isn't praying enough. That'll fix it. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, it looks like you've got nothing but bad news today.
Yes, sadly.
As usual.
Yep. Concentrations of CO2 in the atmosphere have reached a new record high, 419 parts per million, as measured at the Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii. That's 50% higher than pre-industrial levels, the highest in 4 million years. The last time CO2 was this high, global sea levels were nearly 80 feet higher than today, and average temperatures were 7 degrees Fahrenheit hotter. Even though last year emissions did drop by 7% due to pandemic-related economic shutdowns, it barely registered as a blip. Axios meteorologist Andrew Friedman explains that, quote, CO2 levels directly correspond to climate impacts. As long as we're emitting CO2, concentrations will keep building up. It took more than a century to reach 400 parts per million, but it's taken humanity only 8 years to reach 419.
We're good at this.
Global warming, of course, is already impacting us now. The Russian Arctic hit 89 degrees Fahrenheit last week, and this week a blistering extreme heat wave is breaking records across the Middle East, with temperatures running around 15 degrees above normal, driving temperatures to historic levels for this time of year. It's only early June, but several Mideast countries over the weekend tied all-time high national temperature records, some soaring above 125 degrees Fahrenheit a full month before high temperatures reach their annual average peak.
Of course they did. This is hitting us hard, and it's hitting us bad.
Here in the U.S., much of the country is sweltering through an historic early season heat wave. More than 24 million people are under extreme heat advisories, from the Northern Plains to New England, from Texas all the way up into Canada. At least six states set new record highs on Monday, with several cities in the East Coast declaring heat emergencies. The heat is intensifying storms in the South and severe drought conditions across the West, including fueling wildfires.
See what I said about this is getting bad?
In India, where the annual monsoon season begins this month, a new study concludes that man-made global warming will likely make India's increasingly erratic monsoon seasons even more intense and severe. Researchers studying a million years' worth of ice core data found that higher CO2 levels levels and associated global warming were major factors in past monsoon intensity. They confirm monsoons are already intensifying now and warn, quote, the risk of catastrophically strong monsoon seasons is very likely to get worse because of man-made climate change.
Just more warnings that we can ignore. Don't be silly.
A different study projects that the price of tea could soar due to man-made climate change because a quarter of the world's tea is produced in India, where heavier rains have washed away crops and eroded soil. Finally, venerable 95-year-old British naturalist and filmmaker Sir David Attenborough calls his latest film, A Life on Our Planet, a first-hand witness account of what he has seen happen to the planet, and he gave an uncharacteristically stark assessment in an interview with 60 Minutes on Sunday.
You call the film a witness statement. A witness statement is given when a crime has been committed.
Yeah, well, a crime has been committed, and it so happens that I'm of such an age that I was able to see it beginning.
But he also sounds a note of cautious optimism if humanity can ramp up clean, renewable energy.
If we could solve the problems of storage and transmission, the world is ours. We have all the power we need. Why should we go on poisoning life?
Because poison pays, Sir David, and it pays well. And this is a guy who's been watching this stuff for a very long time. Yeah, he's kind of old.
Yeah.
No more Mr. Nice Guy there. For much more on all of these reports and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget, you can download our reports anytime via Stitcher, TuneIn, Google, or Apple Podcasts. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So officially they're saying the Keystone XL pipeline is kaput. It's about time. Look, yeah, this was one of those things that was doomed from the beginning. It's about time we stop fighting over it and start moving towards, hey, what's the next generation of fuel going to be? How are we going to move forward and stop bickering over this? How are we going to invest in the future energy that's going to help our planet? Or, you know, maybe we just figure out how to change the orbit of the sun and the moon. Crazy stuff. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day, our good friend, former Ohio congressman and political analyst Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. We're going to call it the Rick Smith Orbit because your show is out of this world. So we're going to call it the how about that?
Look at that. Out of this world. No, I think out of his mind is more like it for Louis Gohmert. What in the heck was that?
Well, look, well, first of all, of course, the orbit doesn't cause the, you know, climate change. Yeah, humans and other things do. But he's trying to make a point about that, you know, somebody has told him, this is what I think happened, because he won't respond. Somebody has told him that the Earth's orbit has something to do with this. So he was trying to make the point, you know, to NASA, can you change the Earth's orbit? Otherwise, you can't do anything with climate control. So somebody told him that.
It wasn't even NASA he was asking. He was asking the Bureau of Land Management, the Forestry Department. You go, what exactly is Yogi Berra going to do? Explain to me what you expect the forest ranger to do.
But they have to call NASA for him. So, I mean, that's, you know, I've been in these hearings before where a member will say something ridiculous. The people testifying usually are, you know, pretty career people, and they probably would answer, well, I'll call NASA and get back to you, honestly.
Well, she did. The woman who was talking to him, she did say, well, I'll look, and she was laughing she was laughing.
Yeah.
She goes, yeah, I'll look into it for you, buddy.
Sure. Right.
Still, you know, this has been a crazy week already, though. Your state's nuts. My state's nuts too, but you know, I guess, are you magnetic when you walk by, you know, is it metal? Does metal stuff just stick to you? Cause I know you got the vaccine. Are you magnetic now?
No.
did you see this Dr. Tenpenny, I guess it was yesterday or the day before, testifying before your legislature?
Yeah, well, they invited the Ohio doctor, Sherry Tenpenny, and she was invited by the GOP, and this was State House testimony, and she said that the vaccine causes magnetism. So I'm not sure who invited her, but this has got to be one of those things that, you know, whoever invited her, if they've got an opponent, they're going to be saying, okay, it's probably usually when these things happen, from my history, 14 years in the legislature, right? Usually when you get somebody and you chair a committee, one of your members says, hey, can I have so-and-so testify? And you say, sure. And then when they testify, you just think, okay, they must either be a contributor of this legislator or have them blackmailed, one of the two.
One of the two.
To come off with stuff like this, seriously, just I don't know.
But, you know, I'm looking at this woman and I'm going, you know, she claims to be a doctor. And, you know, I'm going, you know, does she have any patients? And if you're a patient, are you not running for the exit?
Mm-hmm. Right. See, the chairman of the committee is Scott Lipps, and he's a Franklin, all right, Republican.
Right.
And he now, for the press in Ohio, in the Columbus Dispatch, is saying, I allowed Tenpenny to testify because Representative Jennifer Gross, a Republican Westchester, which is, by the way, near Boehner, former speaker, insisted she's the sponsor of the bill, and she insisted. So now you know how these things happen. Now, this is where, if you're chairman, later on, you shut the door and you say, you're out of your mind. You're not going to ever get a bill from me. That's what you do.
Yeah, you got to hold somebody accountable. Because
you do that.
Because now your state is the laughingstock of not just of Ohio, but the entire country, and more likely the globe. Because I don't know if you've seen some of the memes that are going around of all the things that are sticking to people.
Yeah, right. And you know, by the way, this Dr. Tenpenny is a physician, actually licensed in Ohio. Usually I like to follow up by saying they need to see where she went to school and they need to investigate the school.
Yeah.
That's what they need to do.
And not the Donald Trump School of Medicine either.
You know, by the way, she is an author of a book. I don't know if you saw the title of it. Saying No to Vaccines.
Yeah. She's, according to her website, she's a doctor and a voice of reason. I'm sorry saying that you got the vaccine, and because of 5G technology, you're now this robot kind of magnet that attracts, you know, the silverware at the dinner table.
Yeah, I guarantee you the chair of the committee, Lips, I guarantee you, had no concept. And once this witness started, he had to have sat there and said to staffers, okay, somebody is losing their job today.
Yeah, I almost went and listened to her podcast. Which is the Tenpenny Files, where she delves into her 10,000 hours of research on the coronavirus, which if you did the math, and I think one of the reporters out in Ohio did, there have only been like 11,000 hours since the virus began.
Damn right.
So I'm going, what did you, I don't know what you were doing for 10,000 hours, because I don't know that there's that much research out there.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, it was a day to behold.
Yeah, crazy. Also, speaking of a day to behold, I wanted to get your thoughts on the transportation bill, which has gone kind of as I expected. The Republicans came out and you know, did the, hey, let's do something, and then it basically collapses, and now they're blaming Biden for, I guess, Shelley Moore Capito said that he kept moving the goalposts, and I agree, he did keep moving the goalposts from $2.2 trillion to $1.7 trillion down to $1 trillion. She's right. He kept moving it. They weren't moving it.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, you know, the House Republicans introduced a $400 billion transportation bill, and I just read an article about a half hour ago, Rick, where they're debating they might have to do it without the House Republicans. Well, then do it without the House Republicans. And I was on the Transportation Committee. Had this happened when we controlled the committee, or if the Democratic side controlled the committee, either side, if this had happened, then they don't get their earmark projects.
Right.
That's
what happens.
No bacon for you.
The states will all get money, but the special earmarks, you know, if you don't play on a fair format, you don't gain.
No bacon
That's
for you.
The rules of the Congress.
That's it. No bacon for you.
Exactly.
And will Democrats do that? Because Democrats don't seem to have. And you can correct me if you think I'm wrong. They just don't seem to have that kind of killer instinct that Republicans have had, you know, historically, to where they're really going to hold people to account. I just don't see them as that kind of. They're kind of spineless in my view.
I mean, when I was there, and people would say, well, this is ugly, it's not right, blah, 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 but it's the system. When I was there, we had the appropriation bills, 13 of them. If you got something in the appropriation bill, you would be asked a question. Will you vote for this? If you said no, it most likely would vanish. You know?
Yeah.
That's the way it ran.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that, you know, you don't play fair with people, but on certain things, you know, why are you going to give earmarks to somebody who is not going to support the bill when you can get somebody that's going to support the bill and support what they want?
No, I'm right there with you. And this is how, you know, I just had this interesting conversation with an older guy today who, you know, was like, he's saying that the bills are so much bigger and so much complicated, much more complicated today. Is that accurate? I mean, did you guys have like 3-page bills back in your day?
Well, it depended on, you know, it would depend on the issue. I mean, we had a lot of pieces of legislation, you know, were large, lots of them. Normally, you know.
Yeah, he was going on this idea that, you know, the past was so much better because everything was simpler and we didn't have all this stuff. And I'm going, no, as I remember.
No, we had large bills. I mean, you could have a 3-page bill, but you're not going to have a transportation 3-page
right.
bill.
Exactly.
You're not going to have a Help America Vote Act, which we did as a 3-page bill. Now, you want to name a post office, I can do that in a page.
Right.
Yeah, or two.
But his point was, is he didn't believe that the kind of horse trading that I know went on back in the old days, he didn't believe that stuff went on. And I'm like, how do you think you got libraries and hospitals and bridges to somewhere? How do you think you got all that stuff? You got it because there were backroom deals that happened. You got it because people went and got drunk with each other and worked out their differences. Mm-hmm. Now we got C-SPAN and 24-hour cable news. Nobody can get drunk and hang out together anymore.
Right. And, well, I mean, I had a constituent that called me one time, and they're like, vote against that bridge to nowhere. And I said, that's Chairman Young's bridge to nowhere. Well, I want you to vote it down. And I said, I have $58 million in there, which, you know, does a lot of economic good in Appalachia. I don't care. I want you to vote it down. I'm like, no, I don't care if it goes to one person. You know, it's there. You know, it never got funded anyway. But I'm just saying that, you know, the constituent at the time was shocked this goes on. And, I was pretty blunt with them about, you know, I have $58 million in there. And it's going to help a lot of people and a lot of jobs.
And that's how we used to get things done. That's how our infrastructure got done. You brought projects home. There were ribbon cutting ceremonies. There were all those things that helped, you know, the incumbents stay incumbents. And we got the stuff we needed. It seemed to be, I don't know, somewhat workable.
Yeah, well, there was Bud Schuster from Pennsylvania. And I'm trying to remember, wonderful gentleman, the Democrat at the time, the minority ranking member of transportation. Anyway, the two of them would, you know, they would just be fantastic in the committee and praising each other. And, you know, it was one happy family.
Are you surprised that it's this hard to get an infrastructure bill pushed through?
Yeah, I am in shock because we did two infrastructure bills. Think about this for a second. This was the Gingrich Congress, right? You know, the after 40 years, the takeover. So, you know, it was a hot time. Let's face it. An impeachment vote of Bill Clinton, right? Clinton's president. And we mustered through two bills. You know, I mean, easily the transportation bill. And then later on in 2006, when Bush was there. Now, Andy Card, Bush's chief of staff, made it difficult because he wanted all prevailing wage taken out of the projects, and we wouldn't allow that. Once we ran over him with a bulldozer, then we got the second transportation bill around 2005 or 6. Rick, they were easy to do in a sense. Yeah. Major legislation, very cooperative, people work together. I am in complete shock that Trump in the first year didn't do one, And I'm still sitting here in shock now that we are going to be into June and there's not one now coming out of the Congress.
No, I'm right there with you. I said, the day after his inauguration, I'm going, if he puts through an infrastructure bill and a big one that he's talking about, $2 trillion he was talking at the time, he does that. He's unbeatable in 4 years. If he goes that route and creates jobs and does that kind of thing, he's going to be unbeatable. Unfortunately, he decided to go the other way, attack the Affordable Care Act and get his tax cuts. That was his legacy, and not the kind of infrastructure. Now, we had a lot of infrastructure weeks. Those were fun. We got to see him behind the wheel of a truck and him yelling at a kid, cutting the grass, that kind of stuff. But we didn't get much done.
Well, he should have done the bill. I thought that would be the first thing out of the Trump administration, program. I really did. I thought it was somebody I thought would tell him, look at the history of these things.
So do you think this gets done? Do you think they push it through? Do you think Manchin comes around? I mean, you're near West Virginia. You kind of have a sense of how Manchin operates. Does he come around on this?
I think what they're going to do, this is my guess, they're going to peel off parts of this bill. And they won't just do just the infrastructure. They'll peel off. I look at the bill as four parts, And then there's the regular, roads and bridges, et cetera. And then there's the other three parts, someone dealing with senior and modern technology. I think they peel off pieces of the other three parts and put it into a measure that Manchin will support. And then some of the heavy lifting on the pieces remaining, they might have to battle it out and maybe hope to get an R vote out of that somewhere. Maybe an environmental vote. I don't know. Collins, I have no idea. But I think they might peel part of it off and get Manchin.
Yeah. Last question I've got for you on the China bill yesterday. I'll tell you, I was surprised 19 Republicans came along to vote on that. And also 8 Republicans voted to keep prevailing wage in the bill that Cornyn had wanted to strip out. A little shocked I was.
Well, I think it's great. I don't think it with the Republicans of what it isn't what it used to be when I was there. But I was there, and Andy Card. I had a vicious conversation with Andy Card myself, vicious. But when he was there, he was furious. And it's too long for your show, but there was a long history to Andy Card. He was a state rep. He blames Bush 41 for losing the election over transportation bill that wasn't all it was cracked up to be, blah, blah, blah. So he gets in the White House with Bush 43. And all of a sudden, he's trying to sink it. There were 50 of us, 50 Republicans in the House that said, no, you're not getting a bill if you strip prevailing wage. And so in those days, it became, the kind of even Gingrich would say, are you guys OK on this bill? Yeah, we're all right. Just keep prevailing wage. I'm shocked, though, now that, that there's that many honestly around.
Yeah, I was
good. It's good news, I think, obviously, for labor.
Yep, I was shocked though, but we'll see how this all plays out. But Bob, I appreciate the time as always.
Thank
good
you,
stuff.
Rick. Thank you.
Good stuff. Our good friend Bob Nay. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1954. That was the day that marked the public downfall of Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy. Senator McCarthy had become the public face of anti-communist hysteria during the Cold War. He used his position as senator to make wild accusations against alleged communists in the U.S. government. He ruined careers and ramped up public fears of a menacing communist threat. Public officials, labor leaders, university presidents, and Hollywood stars and directors all became potential targets of the Red Scare. The hysteria took a particular toll on the labor movement. In 1946, Congress overrode President Harry Truman's veto and passed the Taft-Hartley Act. The act required that all Union leaders sign an affidavit that they were not communists. Those with ties to the Communist Party, or those who simply refused to sign the loyalty pledge on principle, faced expulsion from the labor movement. The communist purges ripped the labor movement apart, expelling some of the most progressive and radical leaders. Senator McCarthy was the public face of the anti-red witch hunts. But some in the public began to question his bullying tactics. Then the senator made an unfounded claim that the army had been infiltrated by communists. For 2 months, the American public watched as Senator McCarthy conducted televised hearings into the United States Army. Joseph Welch served as the chief legal counsel for the army. Senator McCarthy accused another lawyer of Welch's firm of having communist ties. Angered, Welch asked,
"Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency?"
Many in the public watched the testimony and wondered the same thing. McCarthy's popularity and power was finally checked.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
A couple days ago, I got an email, and I got an email from a listener who asked what I thought of Tom Perez and Tom Perez's new gig, and I haven't been able to talk about it. It's one of those things I just haven't been able to bring myself to the reality that the guy who was the former DNC chairman, was Barack Obama's labor secretary, has just taken a gig with an anti-union law firm. Their focus is to counsel and train clients on union avoidance. These are union busters. It's just one of those things. I go, I'm struggling, and I haven't been able to talk about it because I'm not allowed to use profanity. The FCC doesn't allow me to use profanity on the radio airwaves. So I chose to kind of hold off a little bit before I brought this up because I don't have the bleep button, but it would just be one. I do, but it would just be one giant long bleep, because this is the kind of stuff that infuriates me about Democrats. They are, in a lot of cases, as big of a problem as the Republicans are, because when they leave governance, when they go into the private sector, it's right to the worst places, pushing the worst policies. And look, I know people need to work. They need jobs. But seriously, the former labor secretary going to work for a union buster? Are you kidding me? I mean, but that's what Tom Perez has done. He is now working for, a union buster. Now, look, a bunch of them. I mean, Jay Carney was the top union busting flack for Amazon. Robert Gibbs, he spent several years, you know, as McDonald's hit guy. There's been a bunch of them. You know, Obama's senior advisor, David Flof, he's a policy chief for Uber. Valerie Jarrett sits on the board of Lyft. These are people who don't have labor values at their heart, and they wonder why they have lost the working class of this country. It's infuriating, it's angering, it's all of those things, and I wish I could say what I really think, but I don't have the money to pay the fines. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, thericksmithshow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone, take the program on the go, wherever you go, and as always, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.